good evening, everyone, or good morning, or good afternoon, whatever the case may be. Wherever you are on this rotating and rocking and rolling globe, we're going to talk a bit about California tonight from obviously a very unusual perspective. I mean, there's so many unusual things going on that when I talked with Rick Levine earlier in the week and I said, let's do something really different. And I didn't really go through a lot of details as to what I wanted to talk about. And then it came back with the title of tonight's show, which you're going to want to go there anyway. So you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, click on that, you know, that's our URL. When you click on that, it will take you to our homepage, and then you will see the banner for tonight's show, the 6th of July of 2009. We are halfway through the year. I mean, can you believe it? Halfway through the year. And I got to tell you, you're going to have to fasten your seatbelts because the second half of this year, apropos some comments I made a few days ago, I think on the air, that the 30th of June marked the literal 19.5 point of this year, 2019. And of course, 19.5 and the 219 gives you 39, which is the double tetrahedron in the sphere, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, I said to Rick, let's do something kind of apropos of what's going on. And he sent me this really amazing banner, The Disintegration of Reality. And I thought, well, you can't get any more Twilight Zone than that. So that's where we are tonight. So before I do anything further, let me talk a bit about this this earthquake, because we're going to be discussing this earthquake back and forth for the rest of the evening in various modalities. On July 4th at 10:33 a.m. local time, a 6.4 hit Southern California, well to the east, 240-some miles to the east of Los Angeles, but just north of a place I know quite well, which is Barstow, California, which is where the Goldstone NASA JPL tracking station, the major Goldstone Earth station of the Deep Space Instrumentation Facility, also called the Deep Space Network, this field of very, very, very large antennas, 70 meters and, you know, 30 meters and all that out there. It struck just north of there near a little town of, let me see if I can remember the little town. It's one that apparently has 30,000 people in it, but it's called Ridgecrest, Mojave Desert. They say here 125 miles northeast of Los Angeles. Anyway, so on the morning of July 4th, which is the American birthday celebration by one and all, this very potentially disastrous quake struck. I mean, 6.4 is nothing to sneeze at. Now, one of the things I picked up as I've been doing research, which I had forgotten because many years ago I thought I understood the Richter scale, but each number on the Richter scale, like 4, 5, 6, they're separated by a factor of 32. So a 4 is 32 times more powerful than a 3, and a 5 is 32 times more powerful than a 4, and you work your way up the scale. So this earthquake, 6.4, was nothing to sneeze at. Now, apparently there were some windows broken, and there was stuff knocked off shelves in supermarkets and liquor stores and all that, but nobody got really injured, and nobody died. So fast forward the film. That was Thursday morning. Friday night, and I think local time 7:13, it hits again. Within a few miles of the epicenter of the 6.4, there's a 7.1. Now that's like 30 times more powerful than the one than the previous morning. And furthermore, and this is, we're going to get into this in deep discussion. That was a pun, as you'll hear in a moment, with my guest of the morning, who I will introduce momentarily. But the first one was rather, it wasn't really, really deep. It was kind of a mid-range. It was 6.6 miles down. The second one, the 7.1, was 6/10 of a mile down. Now, these numbers, I had someone who was a kind of a numerologist send me a whole analysis looking just at the numbers, and they came to the conclusion, and I'm going to talk about this, you know, as we go through the evening and morning. They came to the conclusion that this isn't natural. And why would that be something we want to talk about? Well, before we get into that, let me introduce my guests. Our first guest of the morning, if I can do this properly here, is Rick Levine. Now, why did I want Rick on? Rick is a hyperdimensional astrologer, a term I've kind of coined, and we'll see whether he kicks and screams about that. His bio says he's a professional astrologer since 1976, becoming a respected leader in the global astrological community. He's the past president of the Washington State Astrological Association, or rather Astrology Association, co-founder of StarIQ.com, a founding trustee of Kepler College, and co-author of 8 years of Barnes & Noble's annual Your Astrology Guide. Rick wrote a daily horoscope column for nearly 17 years, delivered via the internet to literally millions of readers per day through Tarot.com. He is the subject of a DVD, Quantum Astrology, Science, Spirit, and Our Place in the Cycles of History. His internet videos reach tens of thousands of people every month, and in 2018, Rick was awarded the prestigious International Astrologer of the Year Award by the Krishnamurti Institute of Astrology in Kolkata, India. I'm probably mangling that terribly. On a recent lecture tour to Istanbul, I think that may be a typo, Rick. Rick was awarded the coveted Fomalhaut Award for Astrological Excellence, Fomalhaut being a rather bright star, by the Turkish School of Astrology. His current video teachings are available at www.patreon.com/RickLevine or Rick Levine. They run all those letters together. And there's a whole bunch of other links under his bio on the other side of midnight. Georgia Lambert, who you have met many, many, many times on the show, has over 50 years of experience in the field of esoteric studies, receiving formal training in Eastern and Western disciplines, methods, and traditions. She was the first to be licensed by the state of California to teach meditation and esoteric physiology, an experimental course she presented for 3 years at the College of Osteopathic Medicine of the Pacific. She also was part of Manly Hall's foundation in Southern California and is our kind of resident metaphysician. So, boys and girls, welcome to the other side.
Good evening.
Or good morning.
Well, good evening and thanks. Good evening, and thanks for having us.
I hope I didn't mangle that intro too much, Rick.
No, but it is Krishnamurti Institute in Kolkata, which used to be Calcutta.
Oh, that's okay. Okay, so the spelling all got changed, and that's why I didn't recognize. Okay, well, you live and learn. Live and learn. So, Georgia, let's start with this earthquake, because we were talking before we went on the air that you live not very far from where this is all taking place, kind of southwest by, I thought I calculated something like, I think I was way overestimating how far away you are. I would say it's probably more like less than 200 miles. And you've been feeling it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was very interesting the other night, let me tell you.
Are we talking about the one in the morning or the one on Friday night, last night?
On Friday night, yeah, last night.
Oh, this is the 7/13 one, okay.
Right, right.
What were you doing?
Well, this is very glamorous. I have a Great Dane who drinks out of the bathroom sink when she wants water.
Oh, I thought you were going to say something else, okay.
So I was in the bathroom turning on the faucet for the dog. And all of a sudden, I got really, really dizzy. And just a second or two after that, it started shaking. And of course, you know, we had had the one earlier that morning, so I thought, oh,
you mean the previous morning, or we talking
previous morning, yeah. And I thought, oh gosh, aftershock, you know. And then it started to wind down, and I thought, okay, it's winding down. And then it came in stronger, and I thought, oh boy, this one is either bigger or closer.
Oh.
Because, you know, you get used to those kinds of tremblers here in Southern California. But this one, you know, I was both in the Sylmar earthquake and in the Northridge earthquake. So I thought, this one's going to be big. And I held on to the sink and held on to the dog and just stayed there until it was
so
over.
When you say it was really rock and roll, you know, for those folks that listen to us, because we have listeners all over the world, many luckily are not in earthquake zones. What does something like that feel like physically?
Well, it depends on the kind of quake. For instance, the Northridge quake was like an abrupt, sharp slam. And then the whole thing shook. This one was like being on a boat. It was very odd. It was very rolling and gentle. Now, I'm sure it wasn't at the epicenter, but from where I was, it was very boat-like. And I don't remember one exactly like that before. Let me tell you something interesting. One of my students who lives down here in Southern California mentioned, and you can check this out. I haven't checked it out yet, but she said that the town of Ridgecrest is kind of in the middle of a triangle of three military installations, the Naval Warfare Base, which is Navy, Fort Irwin, which is Army, and Edwards, which is Air Force.
Oh, that's right. Edwards is up there too. See, I'm familiar with the Navy, which is the China Lake installation. I actually did a project with a physicist at China Lake many, 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 many years ago. And it was very difficult communicating because, of course, everything going in and coming out has to be cleared. So it was very... It was an unusual project. I'll just say that. So, yeah, that's in the area where we have a lot of top secret stuff going on.
Yeah, but I thought being in the middle of that triangle of the three military groups was kind of poetic.
Yeah, and as I said, just a few miles away, as the crow flies, is Goldstone, which is the major NASA downlink station of the DSN, for all the unmanned spacecraft all over the solar system, both ours, and we also share time with other nations where, you know, when they send data back to Earth, a lot of it comes through the NASA DSN and then is forwarded on to them like a kind of like a packet service. So this is a very interesting part of the country.
Yeah, well, you know, we've got lots of stuff here in Southern California.
So go back to how you were feeling, because what I'm intrigued with, and I think this feeds into what Rick and I are going to talk about in a minute, this blend of physics, metaphysics, and science, you felt something before the show began, before the sink started to move away from you and the Great Dane.
Yeah, it's like, and I know other people have this too, much stronger than I do. But it's kind of like the air gets warpy is the only way I can describe it. It just gets swimmy.
Now, keep talking. Define what swimmy means.
You're slightly lightheaded, slightly dizzy. And, of course, you know, some of the kinds of meditation work that I'm involved in involves the area in front of the forehead. And, of course, the pituitary gland is there. And it's been discovered that when the pituitary gland of pigeons is messed with, they can't find their way back. They can't navigate.
Mm.
So there's something within the pituitary that gears into the field. Is the only way I can think about it.
Well, the normal physicist would say you're hypersensitive to magnetic disturbances. But
right.
I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say that this is so consistent with our own model of earthquakes going back many, many, many years, which are torsion phenomenon. They are sudden breaks in the field, the torsion field. And because consciousness and the field are intimately connected and you're a sensitive, you pick up on this. And the key thing here is you felt wavy before the actual seismic energy arrived as sound waves rocking the sink.
Right.
Now, that's really important. And you say it was like the interval was long enough that you noticed you started feeling weird and then the ground started shaking.
Yeah, weird enough because we had had that earthquake the day before. And it flashed through my mind, is this going to be another earthquake?
Is this going to be? And then it was.
Yep, sure was.
Can you estimate roughly the time interval between feeling wonky and the actual physical manifestations of the rocking and rolling?
Just a second or two.
Oh. But see, but
it was enough for me to register it in my brain that is this going to be another quake?
Yeah, because one is limited to the speed of sound in rock, which is very fast. It's thousands of feet per second. And the other is not limited, we don't think, even to the speed of light. So you were getting the instantaneous, it's happening, and then the physical effects followed, you say, by about a second. That's really interesting.
I've heard of some people that can feel them days in advance. I'm not in that category at all. I'm just sensitive to electrical stuff.
Well, but wait. Maybe you are, and this is not applicable to this experience, because if this was not, and we'll talk about this through the evening, a normal earthquake, if this in fact was some kind of weapon that is being demonstrated, that is being used in some geopolitical maneuver against, well, who would it be against? Obviously, if it's in the middle of all those research facilities, highly secret, you know, military, whatever, it's either against the U.S. military and or it's against the top of the command structure, which would be the current president of the United States. Thoughts?
I don't even know how to speculate on that.
Well, if this is a directed energy manifestation, i.e. technology shifting the field.
Unless they're practicing.
Yeah, but why would they practice? Why would they have to practice twice and then initiate all those aftershocks, which really, I mean, think of the location. They're so lucky. People are so lucky that so few live in that area, because a 7.1 underfoot is really, you know, somebody should have died and nobody has died. Isn't that interesting? I mean, this almost takes us from the realm of terrestrial guys playing war games to a higher level of something which is able to manifest this demonstration, if that model is assumed, but in a way that nobody has died. And that's statistically really weird.
Yeah, if that 7.1 had hit, you know, under Los Angeles, it would have been pretty devastating.
Oh, my God. Katie barred the door. Rick, jump in here. What are your thoughts on this? Because you live in Seattle, so you're not feeling any of this. But you're looking at what's going on, and you have a brain, and you connect dots. And what have your thoughts been over the last few days?
A couple of things. First of all, I did live almost a decade in Los Angeles and experienced several earthquakes there, including the 1987 Whittier quake, which was quite strong. And the three or four quakes that I actually experienced, and since I've been in Seattle, there was one earthquake here that was registerable on the map of perception, significant even. The thing is, and Georgia kind of used the words, and as she said this, immediately my mind went to an experience that I have had in each of the quakes I've experienced. And it's an experience that I've only had as distinct experiences in a couple of other instances. Let me tell you what the experience is first, and let me tell you when I've had it. The experience is that what Georgia called wavy and or wonky, the experiences that those things which are solid, those things which are three-dimensional and solid, kind of begin to shimmer and feel like there's a sense of transparency. The word I would use is ionized, which may not mean anything to, you know, there's just a feeling of what happens when things begin to like buzz at a very, very high frequency. And during an earthquake or just prior to it, looking around, the buildings, the ground, the everything seems to have that kind of solid isn't solid anymore kind of a feeling to it.
You guys both have been out in the desert and you've seen the sun baking the desert and you see the heat waves, the shimmering. Is it kind of like that?
It's not quite
for me. Go ahead.
For me, it's kind of like that if you could translate that visual into a physical feeling.
Oh.
And for me, it was visual, but it was not quite the shimmering. It was a much higher frequency and more energetic. It wasn't like fuzzy, hazy. It was very sharp. But let me tell you the two other instances in my life where I've had that identical experience. I mean, enough like it was like deja vu-ish. One time was many years ago, back in the early 80s, maybe late 70s, I had the distinct, pleasure, experience of spending some time with Uri Geller. And I watched more spoons and forks and pieces of metal tie themselves up into weird knots than I would even care to admit that I saw. But I did. And what I took away from that particular day, without judging that phenomena, is that every time a damn spoon began to bend, when I looked at it, it looked like the metal was like jumping, and it was like it wasn't quite transparent, but it looked like the actual fork or spoon was kind of like, again, I come back to that word, like ionized. It looked like it was like jittering. I wish you could see my hand going back and forth, kind of like high frequency. All right, that's one other time. The other time where I've had that identical experience is in, let's just say, in my youth when I had some very intense psychedelic experiences where that which is solid becomes not solid and buzzes with its own energy as if it's alive and buzzing. And the earthquakes for me that I've experienced all had that same kind of feeling that which is solid is not really solid. Solidity is an illusion, and you get to somehow see its true nature, which is more transparent and fluid and in some other state of matter.
This almost sounds like frequency matching.
Absolutely does. Now, one other thing I want to say just very quickly is that, and there's a reason why I want to get this on the record, is that the second earthquake was actually at 8:19 p.m. according to the USGS. It was 8:19 p.m., 11 miles outside of Ridgecrest. And the reason why the time is so important is that at that moment, within about 10 minutes of Earth time, the planet Saturn and the nodal axis, that's the place where the intersection of the moon's orbit around the Earth and the Earth's orbit around the moon is the intersection of those two orbits.
Right.
Saturn right now is at that nodal point, and that axis was on the horizon at Ridgecrest at 8:19 p.m. at the moment that the earthquake struck. That's pretty crazy.
On the eastern horizon, the rising horizon.
It's on the rising, on the eastern horizon.
My.
Saturn was actually at 17 degrees, 29 minutes of Capricorn. The nodal axis is at 17 degrees, 43 minutes, and the actual eastern point itself was 17 degrees, 21 minutes, all from a celestial standpoint, close enough to create rock and roll. Now, the interesting thing about this, and there's more to say on this, but I don't want to hijack the conversation completely, is that Saturn and Pluto are coming into their once every 33 to 35 year alignment, and they are both retrograde, meaning they're on the same side of the sun as the Earth is, meaning that these planets are very close to the Earth right now. And you add to the fact that Mercury, in its regular back and forth cycle, was stationary, turning retrograde tomorrow, but around that 2 or 3 day period when Mercury technically makes its station to turn retrograde or direct, it's like it stops moving from Earth's point of view and gains tremendous torsional integrity, power. Newton would have called it inertial gravity.
Now, when does this happen again?
Well, the actual moment that Mercury actually turns direct is tomorrow evening.
So we're in a Mercury retrograde right now.
Well, not until tomorrow evening, but practically, Mercury ain't moving. So Mercury is holding still, and Saturn and the nodal axis was on the same parallel, was on the same plane as the horizon of the Earth at Ridgecrest, and just the astrology is pretty astounding. There's more, but that's enough. That's enough for now.
Hmm. And metaphysically, Saturn is considered the Lord of Karma.
Well, it is, but it's also the planet of the three-dimensional reality.
I was just going to say, it's the planet of reality, and that's the theme of our show tonight. So, go ahead.
Let me just say that it's been said for historically that Saturn is the planet of reality, and then the planets past Saturn, like Neptune, these are the planets of surreal dream imagination. But Rob Hand, one of our modern astrology wise men, says it might be that Neptune is reality and Saturn is simply the illusion that there was one. That's a nice little twist.
Wheels within wheels within wheels.
That's my opening volley. Back to you, boss.
Well, what all this – the bottom line here is the celestial portents, which in the hyperdimensional model are critical, apparently have created this window. And if you want to propose that somebody walked through and did something in this window to either get attention or to change the future or to change reality, you couldn't have picked a better time, right?
That's right. And if no one did it, the universe couldn't have picked a better time either. Oh, it's also halfway in between two eclipses.
Somehow,
an eclipse season often coordinates with earthquakes, often.
Well, that there's probably a mundane explanation having to do with gravity fields and all that. I'm looking at something a little more exotic here, which
I'm
is
sure you are.
Well, if you think in terms of hyperdimensional windows, anyway, hold it there. My guest this morning, Georgia Lambert, Rick Levine, and guess what? We're on a trip to here. Here on the other side of midnight, my name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall, hopefully, return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to the other side of midnight on this Saturday evening, July 6th, as we grapple with something which is immortal and is of deep interest to us all, which is, did he just say nothing is real? I mean, what is reality? Do we live in multiple realities? Do we time shift between dimensions? Are our realities shared part-time and not shared other times? Can we change our realities? Can we focus and actually move between timelines? And did we, all of us en masse, over the last several years, beginning maybe in November of 2016, did we move into a totally unprecedented, unexpected, unanticipated, and maybe unendurable reality? You're on the other side of midnight. Let me welcome my guests back, Georgia Lambert and Rick Levine. And I think, Rick, this is something that you were thinking about when you sent me some outlines of things to talk about. The Beatles and Strawberry Fields and Nothing Is Real.
Always know sometimes think it's me, but you know I know and it's a dream. I think I know I mean, yes, but it's all wrong. That is, I think I disagree. Let me take you down, cause I'm going to Strawberry Field. Nothing is real, nothing to get hung about. Strawberry fields forever. Strawberry fields forever. Strawberry fields forever.
Okay, Rick, that's about as good a segue as I could arrange. Where do you want to start?
Exactly with that song. That's exactly what's on my mind. There have been a lot of people who have talked a lot about the quote-unquote paradigm shift, about the movement from Newtonian to Einsteinian or quantum physics, about the shift that we've all gone through. However, I think the shift is even greater than many people have imagined, and it began with a crazy discovery by a French chemist, Lavoisier, who is credited with discovering oxygen. But this is in the 18th century. But the interesting thing that we moderners don't understand is that Lavoisier didn't just scientifically discover oxygen. He was the first person to actually claim that there were things that were invisible that still had substance. I mean, let that sink in for a moment, because what we're talking about here is the relationship between physics and metaphysics. And it used to be that the dividing line, the wall between what was physical and what was metaphysical, was a wall as as fixed, as rigid, and as impermeable as Saturn itself. And that wall, starting with the discovery of oxygen, something that was physical, had substance, and yet was invisible, we've now fallen through into a funny house.
Crack in time.
Crack in time would work fine, where what physical and metaphysical are no longer separate. And in some ways, this is corroborated by the understanding of the relationship in modern physics of particle to wave, that those things which are solid are not solid. As Einstein said, reality is an illusion, albeit a very persistent one. But the fact of the matter is that the physical world as we see it is an illusion that's based upon the intersection of high frequency electromagnetic and other waveforms that create the illusion of that which is solid. And so this idea that seeing is believing doesn't work anymore. In fact, the recently passed Wayne Dyer said that actually in these days, believing is seeing. In other words, something has shifted, and the realization that physical is not necessarily what is real, that we do not end at our skin. I'm sure Georgia will attest to this and has already mentioned the fact that, you know, that space that's in front of our pineal glands is, you know, is part of us, but it's also, you know, a piece of us. And the fact is that we have gone through this eye of a needle, and there is no going back. You know, you can go back to the writing of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who hypothesized this noosphere, this idea that human thought itself would basically encircle the planet and become something unto itself. And with the advent of the World Wide Web and communication in high frequency realms, whether it's radio or television or you know, all these high frequency radiating waveforms, cellular communication, we've now created this exonervous system, this kind of frequency envelope around us that has confirmed the fact that physical does not necessarily describe reality.
Georgia?
Exactly. And the metaphysical model states that we are moving, as we move into this next age, this next 2,000 some hundred year period, called, you know, the age of Aquarius or the age of the seventh ray, or, you know, there's lots of different names for it. But one of its factors is that humanity's reality, which has been limited to solids, liquids, and gases, is now extending into the next layer of life, which will include things like what Curly in photography shows, in medicine, the energy body that underlies the physical, that's part of the acupuncture system. We're going into this next layer of subtle activity, and it's becoming part of our reality. You know, back in a couple of hundred years ago, they would talk about it as the borderland between this world and another, and the veils are growing thin. And they're not only growing thin, they're being rent.
Yep, agreed. Yep. You know, and it's interesting that even the media guru in the 1960s and 70s, Marshall McLuhan, who based a lot of his breakthrough ideas on the works of the English mystical poet William Blake and on James Joyce, McLuhan claimed that the media that we use in, you know, the technology actually has then we create technology, and then technology creates or shapes us. And McLuhan claimed that with the advent of electronic and digital technology, we've actually externalized the biological function of the nervous system, and that we actually have created, we flipped out, his words, we flipped out, we created an exonervous system.
Well, all you, all you have to do, Rick, is go into a restaurant and look around. What do you see? What's the overwhelming impression you get if you walk into any restaurant? I don't care whether it's McDonald's or some super high-end, you know, restaurant in New York. What's the overwhelming impression you have of people at dinner these days?
Tell me.
They're all sitting around staring at their hands at little blue screens and talking to each other through their hands.
Of course. And I love to imagine that if 50 years ago you were walking along outside and saw people passing you just talking to themselves, they would be nuts, you know. And
yeah.
Now they do. I mean, but they're but here's the thing, Richard, that's so important is that this exonervous system that is now out there that we all plug into and out of, you know, this external mind, whatever we want to call it. We've not only flipped out, but we've gone psychotic. And I mean that not to be funny, because neurosis is curable or at least manageable by learning the truth, by discussion, by communication, by recreating the past in therapy. However, psychosis is not. You know, schizophrenia is not cured by therapy. And by what's going on in the world recently, especially over the last several years, it's like you can take people with different points of view, different perspectives, and put them in dialogue. And the more they talk, the further apart they get. It's not a neurotic situation where we can repaint the truth. We've gone psychotic. We've flipped out and freaked out, and it is a pretty kind of crazy place we're in these days.
I have met more people, you know, because what I do is kind of not normal, and I try to support what I'm doing with evidence. And I'm encountering more and more people who will say to me, I don't believe any of that. I have my own beliefs. And no matter what evidence I try to array in support of a position or a discovery or whatever, they are immutable. They are unreachable. They're like in bubbles that the bullets will bounce off. Their processes cannot be affected by reality as buttressed
Absolutely.
By evidence.
Yep.
But that's understandable. You know, every time we have this great change of an age, you have the resistance of all of the old paradigms and belief systems and forms. And so there are those that will lend themselves easily to this new horizon that's opening up. And there are others that are going to fight it tooth and claw to the very end because it's too scary to move into something different. You know, people will remain in an unsavory situation just because it's known, and that's safer than the unknown, even if the unknown is better.
Hmm.
Yeah, I agree with that, but you know, Keith just put in the chat box that belief can't control reality, but I'm not convinced that that's the truth. I don't know that I believe that, because I've seen people with 100% belief or denial make changes in the external world or in their body that were impossible. At least if you think that belief can't control reality. I don't know what the limits are here, but I do know that evolution is pushing us into a place where we're going to have to find out what those limits are.
I'm not so much thinking it's evolution as is this phasing cyclic physics of a meta-reality, which I think is modulated by the 26,000-year precessional cycle. So my question is, are we coming up, because in the astronomy we are, to a once in a 26,000-year moment in the cyclic physics to where all kinds of things will become possible that were not possible in previous ages in those 2,000-year increments, because the alignments with the galaxy and the solar system and the Earth and the axis and all that has to be just right for this reality to be bendable, to be malleable, to use George's term, to be warpable.
I think that's true, yeah.
And so, I would like to think it's true, but I don't know, and I don't think that we can know, because our window into the time, the time span that you're talking about is such a tiny slit. It would be like talking butterfly language to a caterpillar. So the answer is, yeah, in theory, I agree with you, but I don't know how to frame it.
Not necessarily so. Are you guys familiar with Isaac Asimov's first short story called Nightfall?
Oh, I love it. It's absolutely one of my favorite books of all time.
It's what's going on now.
I agree with you.
So tell people about Nightfall and why I'm analogizing it to what we're going through right now on Earth.
Well, I mean, to me, the short version of that story is, like Asimov's books, they're often hard to distinguish the science fiction from the reality. It takes place on a planet that feels a lot like Earth, except it's a planet where there's no darkness ever, because there's it's a binary star system, and there's several moons, and there's always light, except once every couple thousand years, there's an alignment that makes complete darkness, and it makes everyone on the planet go completely crazy because no one's ever been in the dark, and they set fire to everything because, just looking up, no one's ever seen a star. No one's ever known there was anything out there. And so I think the analogy, Richard, that you're talking about is, it's the fear of what we don't know that creates the situation that we do anything to prevent from facing it.
That's one level. The other level is the protagonist, the first-person voice narrating Asimov's incredible story, is kind of assimilating for the reader bits and pieces of information. And one of them is, the archaeologists have found, looking for what might happen when this once-in-a-hundred-lifetime event takes place, you know, the two stars align, a moon's aligned, there's a total eclipse, so it gets dark, which they've never experienced. They're looking at clues in the ground to where they seem to see evidence of previous civilizations.
And they just began in the book uncovering another layer, and they're beginning to realize that every 2,000 years there's a new civilization that rebuilds on top of the old one.
And a key marker is the carbon and soot occurring because of vast fires.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, and they don't understand why would these cultures all end by burning. And then, of course, it was the protagonist goes through it, and I'm sorry we're spoiling it for those of you who haven't read it. Go read it anyway. You know,
it's still an amazing read.
Isaac was a genius because he blends science and science fiction seamlessly, which is what happens in the best of those voyages. Anyway. The idea was that each culture destroyed itself by fire because they were trying to light the darkness, because the darkness was this overpowering phenomenon they'd never experienced, which terrified them to death. So they did anything. They burned anything within reach to keep it light because they'd never known darkness. Okay, fast forward the film to our time. We're finding all kinds of evidence around the Earth and around the solar system based on our work that we're not the first. We're not the first high-tech civilization which has gone bonkers and totally destroyed itself, and then you have the long trek back up to civilization again over thousands and thousands of years. What if, guys, this madness which is affecting the human species right now, if it goes on, will we in fact, and this is going to sound really down, will we wind up tearing civilization apart because we can't agree on reality? And we're seeing that all around us now, people who are impervious to facts, impervious to evidence, impervious to normal empirical reality. They live in their own belief system. What if, as the physics keeps changing, these reality systems can compete in the field to create these structured bubbles of separate, isolated realities where, of course, civilization, which is communal, can't function, and we all degrade back, we devolve back to where we have to, as the physics keep changing, back up this long 26,000 year cycle, we start it again and again and again.
You know, I think that what you're saying is very interesting, valid, and true.
And as terrifying as hell.
And terrifying. And as a very quick aside, I would just like to acknowledge the fact that it was Isaac Asimov. Isaac Asimov is the reason I became an astrologer, because I became enamored with the protagonist of his Foundation trilogy, Harry Seldon, who wasn't an astrologer but developed tools, as many of your listeners I'm sure know, that he could predict the outcome of human history by applying these mathematics to the behaviors of humans. And that was so fascinating to me that when I began to learn about astrology, all I could think of was Harry Seldon.
Well, as I've been looking at this, George, you're being very silent. I've been
I'd like to throw in something positive here.
Yeah, by all means. Go ahead.
Since the 1800s and a lot of the Eastern wisdom coming west with people like Blavatsky and others, it has been said that this time, in this change of an age, we don't have to disappear.
Yep.
That this time, it doesn't mean that it will be easy, but this time we can make the transition without that severing of the collective consciousness thread.
And how does that work in the 8 minutes we have till the top of the hour?
In one word, it's awareness.
That's right. You've got it.
Have you noticed
if enough people, whatever that hundredth monkey, component happens to be, if enough people can stay awake and aware during this change, that's enough to keep it together.
Have
regardless of the breakage of the old forms.
Sorry to interrupt, but have you noticed, I want to put this in the conversation because we've got 8 minutes to talk about it. There's a new buzzword in social media, in network television, in just common, ordinary, people talking to each other. They're calling it woke. Woke capitalism, woke this, woke that. It's like the mainstream has suddenly gotten the idea that we have been asleep.
Ah, it's kind of like the old word grok.
Yes.
It dates me, doesn't it?
Well, it's from Heinlein. It's from Moon, the Martian, not the new Martian, Stranger in a Strange Land.
Yeah.
But woke. Suddenly I'm hearing it and seeing it everywhere. And by people that you'd never imagine would think alternate speak.
Yeah.
Anyway, Georgia, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to put that in there. That, see, to me, that's a data point in the favor of your positive model, that enough of us will get through this transition to keep the crazies from really killing what we have built and cherished and want to continue building.
Okay, so just let me interject something here, because Georgia said something that was a moment upsetting when I realized that our conversation, Richard and me, Rick, that our conversation might have sounded negative, because by no means am I negative about this. And let me tell you in a very short paragraph why. And the reason is that with the breakdown of the barrier between physical and metaphysical, in metaphysical reality, there's no drag, there's no lag of seasons, it doesn't take time for things to catch up. It's like having a dream. If something happens, boom, everything changes in a second, and you go from this horrific state to this beautiful state, or from here to there. And by that same token, we live in a world where, as I said earlier, although we've changed from a Newtonian to a quantum paradigm, that because everything that's ever happened and everything that ever will happen is happening simultaneously, it's our brain that gives us the illusion of linearity, I believe many other people do too, that the simple piece of this is that we can change it all on an absolute dime.
You can turn
around instantaneously, because in the realm of metaphysics, it's like it's what the Tibetans call the bardo states. Those states of consciousness that do not have physical drag, change occurs instantaneously, and that, I think, is our potential saving grace, and it only comes from awareness, increasing awareness, not dumbing it down. This, of course, is one of the big battles on the planet, not just in the United States and England and in Indonesia and the Philippines and so on. The big battle is between, are we going to become more woke or more stupid? And I don't mean stupid meaning IQ test. I mean more dumbed down.
And, of course, the biblical version of that is things changing in the twinkling of an eye. Notice it doesn't say eyes, plural. It's twinkling of an eye. And Kabbalistically, this is the movement of humanity from Malkuth, the lowest sphere, to Yesod, where the final sort of etheric tweaks are put on things before they become physically dense. And so we're moving up a notch to where things can change instantaneously.
Yeah, and I would also suggest that the larger piece of this change began in the 1890s, as Georgia talked about, not only Madame Blavatsky, but there was a lot of energy that the rise of theosophy and psychic stuff was going on, and that and this was the same period of time in which Freud wrote The Interpretation of Dreams, and it was also the time at which the planets Neptune and Pluto aligned. This is the slowest moving rhythm of the known planets in our solar system. Neptune catches up with Pluto every 500 years. And they did that in the 1890s, and there was this whole kind of first wave of a taste of the metaphysical predominance over the physical. And I think we're very much still in this particular cycle.
And that's the time when you had science fiction writers emerge, playing with concepts like time travel. You saw this in the arts, where instead of just painting a bowl of fruit, they question, what would that fruit look like if you could look at it from different perspectives all at the same time, at the same instant? The famous painting Nude Descending a Staircase is like still pictures of a film. It's a sequence. So all of these concepts were coming into humanity in all kinds of different ways.
And again, going back to technology, that was the same time that we began manufacturing higher frequency electromagnetic waves, Marconi and Tesla. That's when that was occurring on a technological point of view.
Right.
There's a psychologist, and I'm trying to remember his name, and I was trying to Google while you guys were talking. And I obviously have it wrong. I thought it was Fitzgerald, but it may not be. He has discovered something really remarkable based on standardized IQ tests. He says, and again, I wish I could remember who this guy is, and in the break I'll try to figure it out, that based on multiple phasic tests, IQ tests of different forms from all over the world, not just from the U.S., from all nations, you know, apparently some kind of UN database, that we have all been collectively, according to the tests, been getting smarter and smarter for over 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now you look around at the world and that's obviously nuts. So, I mean, this is why the mainstream has said he's crazy, because obviously that data doesn't support the conclusion. So I'll tell you what, we have to pick this up on the other side of the break. My guests this morning are Rick Levine and Georgia Lambert, and we're talking about cycles, astrology.
Would you like to ride my beautiful moon? We could float among the stars together, you and I. Oh, we can fly.
And you're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
The world is like the place in my beautiful blue.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoglund and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.